Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Guest number one, Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
Well, the $15 billion budget gap has to be closed somehow. What do you like best and least in the governor's budget?
That's a good question. What I guess we like best is some of the things he's doing to make sure that we don't hurt the very poor in the society. But in general, it's an imbalanced approach. You know, if you have a crisis at home, you both cut your spending, you also try to maybe get a second job. The only way we're going to close a budget gap of this size is with three legs of the stool. We need some federal help, we need some serious cuts, and we need some serious revenue. And the fairest way, of course, as you suggested in your opening, from our point of view, of course, is a broad-based tax on those most able to pay. So the governor is asking everyone to sacrifice except those who can actually afford it best.
You know,
and
that
we are perplexed by the whole approach. We think it does not make sense.
The governor says he doesn't want to chase the biggest taxpayers and job creators away. Wouldn't millionaires just move to New Jersey or somewhere?
The rates in New Jersey are substantially higher than they are in New York, so the answer to that is no. Listen, people do not move because you have a slight increase. These are very modest increases. You know, at $250,000 or $500,000 a year, you're making $10,000 a week, and you have to pay a couple of hundred dollars more on that $10,000. That is not going to make you sell your house and move to another state. Everybody depends on having a healthy society. The rich know it. Everybody else knows it, too. For the moment, the governor seems to choose not to know it, although we suspect he knows it as well. And eventually, we will find our way to a fair, progressive income tax system in New York, which we no longer have. You pay the top rate. You know, if you make more than $40,000 a year as a household, you're paying the same rate as someone earning $400,000 or $4 million or $40 million.
Dan,
and it's
have
just
you,
wrong.
Have you crunched these numbers? How much revenue would a millionaire's tax generate, or the way you just proposed it was really over $250,000 a year, kind of like what Obama is looking to reinstitute at the federal level. Can you be specific on how much of these $15 billion in cuts and tax hikes could be offset?
Sure, about a third, a little bit more than a third. So about $5 billion in revenue from the top 2 or 3% of wage earners.
Uh-huh. Then
we're going to need about $5 billion at least from the federal government. And we're going to have to cut about $5 billion. That's a serious amount of money. But you can't ask only part of the society to sacrifice. That's the flaw in the governor's approach from our point of view. And that's going to be the battle. But politics is about, you know, solving these problems nonviolently, and that's what we look forward to.
What's your number for an income tax rate hike? Is it $250,000 plus?
Yeah, $250,000 plus. But it goes up at $500,000, it goes up again at $1 million. If you're making $1 million a year, which is about $20,000 a week, you can afford to pay a bit more in state income taxes to keep the libraries open and the subways running and the schools and the hospitals. I mean, these are all useful things that make civilization civilization, and that's why we are determined to sort of change the debate here. Otherwise, you know, I think the governor's making a political mistake. Every time somebody downloads an iTunes, they're going to think, Patterson's getting his 8 cents. That's not a smart move. We need to have, a different conversation about a balanced approach to balancing the budget.
And listeners, post your reactions to this to our website. Do you like Dan Cantor's income tax hike proposal for New York State? Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party. Go to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, and also answer the general question up there, how would the Patterson budget proposals affect you? Now, before you go, let's assume that ultimately the governor and the legislature do accept your tax structure. Here's the hard part. How would you then, you know, representing the progressive values of the Working Families Party, prioritize as an advocate when it comes to the other two-thirds of the $15 billion? Which of the other tax hikes or service cuts would you remove first, if you could, and
sure,
which would you say, okay, I have to live with this?
Yeah, so we don't like the nuisance taxes, the little nickel and diming that you described earlier on, or and the the tuition hikes, for example, very bad for working and middle-class families. Those are taxes also. So we would favor, on the tax side, getting rid of those things that are, by their very nature, regressive, reducing the sales tax exemption on clothing. It's a terrible idea. On the cut side, we're not unaware that serious cuts are coming to all of the programs that are important. Education is going to take a hit. Healthcare is going to take a hit. Social service and state workers, everybody knows this, and nobody is unwilling to face that reality. But you can't do that without also asking for this more genuine shared sacrifice. So what specific programs? It sounds to me like they're going to have to defer some of the growth in some of the education funding. It sounds like some of the Medicaid cuts are going to be real and painful. But you can't, it just doesn't go down with people to do it only on one side. So I imagine people will, at the end of the day, if there's a sense of fairness, they'll be willing to deal.
Dan Cantor, Executive Director of the Working Families Party. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
I'm further recommending that we cut $698 million from school aid, or a 3.3% cut. If we do this, we have to be aware that we must stay true to our education funding plan from 2007-2008. We will make that plan work, but we're going to have to delay it from 4 years to 8 years.
Reaction to the governor's budget, guest number two, Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. And as a bonus, we'll get her reaction to President-elect Obama's education secretary nominee, Arne Duncan. Hi, Randy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's always great to be with you.
The pension changes, making 62 the minimum retirement age instead of 55 for teachers and others, and making workers contribute. This would be new hires, not present workers. Contribute 3% to the pension system their whole careers instead of only the first 10 years.
Right.
Any problem with those things?
If I was actually answering in a vacuum, people would say, you know, look, that's what everybody else in life does. Although what's happened, Brian, is that we actually have made several different agreements with the city of New York, the last one being just this past year, that creates a whole different plan for teachers. If you remember, we actually did an age 55 retirement that did ask new teachers to pay another 2% as a way of creating not just a better retirement system, but as a way of creating a career path for new teachers to attract and retain them. So my sense has been, and I've always said what Governor Spitzer first said, and beforehand Governor Patterson and Mayor Bloomberg, which is if you can get to agreements on pensions together, that's the way to do it, that one party should not be doing an end run around another party in terms of this. And plus, the agreement that we reached as teachers last year actually, in the long run, helps the city, is cost neutral, and was a way of enticing and retaining teachers.
So are you just digging in and saying, look, we signed a contract, we're not going to reopen the contract in the middle, even in emergency times? Or are you saying you won't be able to attract enough teachers if they have to work till 62 instead of 55?
I'm saying that for teachers, the reason we got to the 55, the age 55 retirement, was because that was the, when you looked at all the research and all the evidence, that's the working lifetime of teachers. And so ultimately, that's what all the research has pointed to, and that's why we got there in terms of adding an amount to get back to a 55 retirement. So we were very responsible in terms of saying, we know in order to get back to a 55 retirement, we have to actually add some funds to do it. But that's what happens in terms of the teaching profession. At the same time, let me just say, we're in the negotiations with the city administration over health costs. We're being very responsible in terms of understanding that the health costs have gone up, and we've tried to figure out what to do about that. And if you've noticed, we're very concerned about the fiscal crisis. The teachers last year, dug deeper into their pockets on supplies, where we used to get about $200 or $250 a year in supply monies that teachers would spend on kids. We get them from the city council. That went down to about $150. So we're willing to do our share. We understand that kind of stuff, but we have to make sure we don't do things that have unintended negative consequences.
Let me
like
ask
what happened
you
in the 70s.
Another piece of it, delaying the campaign for fiscal equity spending from, I guess he's delaying it by 4 years, all this extra money under the court settlement for the New York City public schools, or at least some of it, a lot of it, would be delayed for 4 years. Any reaction to that?
Look, we knew that a deferral of some of this stuff would actually happen. And what I said yesterday was that one of the things we can't do is we can't turn back the clock. We know that we're not going to have the resources, given this fiscal crisis, to move forward in the way that we have in the last couple of years, and we know that. And so I was actually very important that the governor said that this is a dream deferred, not a dream denied. But most importantly, in terms of the governor's budget, is there's two things that we believe need to be fundamentally changed, even though we understand his predicament, which is all of New York's predicament. Number one is that on the cuts, there we have to try to get to a position where we're not cutting into base services of kids. And if New York City at this point needs about $600 million in order to just stay with the constants, with the services that we have right now. And so that's the kind of number we're going to have to look to try to see if we can get just
how,
to where we
how
are
far,
right now.
How far below that is the governor's proposal?
The governor's proposal is the governor actually cut about $200 million from the base, and then if you include the inflationary costs and whatever, the governor's proposal is about $500-600 million from the base of what we need. But look at what has happened now. Between the city cuts and the governor's cut and the state cuts, because these are not the governor's cuts, they're not personal to him. He never would want to do this. You have a city school system that's looking at $1.5 billion less next year than was anticipated in January 08. And that's what we're troubled by, because it's going to cut into core services. Teachers will.
Are you also, just very briefly, are you also for the millionaire's tax, like our previous guest, to close some of this?
Well, what we're for is we're for taxes that have a much more progressive element than a regressive element, meaning for taxes where those of us who can pay more, like myself, should be digging deeper into our pockets to pay more instead of people who are living paycheck to paycheck.
All right. And last thing, while you're here, your reaction to President-elect Obama's choice for education secretary.
He good
is
choice.
Chicago schools chief Arnie Duncan. You're saying good choice.
Good
now,
choice.
From what I read, he's considered an advocate of high-stakes testing, which you don't like, more flexibility in assigning teachers, which you don't always like, but somehow the union there doesn't hate him like your members hate Joel Klein.
I think, Brian, the problem is that if you've noticed, what happens in terms of education is that you cannot morph education into a one-second soundbite. What we've said about testing is that testing can't take over for teaching. There has to be a balance. So we have to have high standards, and we have to have tests that follow it. But the entire curriculum can't be testing and high-stakes testing. So, and what has happened is that even in the era of No Child Left Behind, where schools are closed, where there's high stakes, everything, what Arnie Duncan has been able to do is that he's worked with people in order to try to help all kids succeed. The collaboration element, the having a good curriculum, the working to recruit and retain the best teachers, those are always components of quality education.
All right. Randy Weingarten, President of the American Federation of Teachers. Sorry under these circumstances.
Yeah, me too, Brian.
Thanks a lot.
And yet, after we complete these cuts, assuming that they become part of our budget process, we will still have an increase of school aid by 53% over the last 10 years, which is the highest in the country and is most generous compared to the other states.
Reaction to the governor's budget proposals, guest number three, Catherine Wild, president of the New York City Partnership, representing a lot of the business sector in New York City. Hi, Kathy. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Glad to join you.
And this is the kind of world we're living in right now. We just got word from the MTA fare hike service cut hearing that one of the speakers, somebody named Steve Millis, just tried to throw a shoe at the board of the MTA.
Not good news.
Cuts, hikes, what do you like, what do you not like in the way the governor is going about this?
Well, I think you'd have to start by saying the governor has accomplished his original mission, which was to get everyone's attention. And he certainly did that with his budget message. And I think that he wants everybody to recognize we are facing a real crisis. We're facing a structural change in our state economy where we're going to have to go back to the drawing board on a lot of our underlying assumptions about what we can afford to spend and where our tax burden lies. And so I think that's very positive. I think it's the beginning of a conversation that obviously is going to engage many groups from all sectors, as well as the legislature, most importantly. So I think he's made the right start, and I think his broad approach certainly has captured everyone's attention, has given the sense that what he's trying to do is really fair. He's hitting everybody on the spending side and just about everybody on the tax side. Obviously, the greatest concern, as has been mentioned earlier in the program, and I think we'd agree, is during a down economy, when consumers are suffering, it's pretty easy to say you can raise taxes on discretionary items, whether it is taxes and fees, whether it is driver registration, or whether it's the obesity tax on sugar cola, or increasing tax on wine and beer. You can, you know, those are things that are discretionary. But then there are a number of things where he's proposing to raise taxes, like big tax increase in utilities, health insurance. Those get passed back to consumers, the sales tax on clothing, obviously. And those are essentials. Those are not discretionary items.
So you'd oppose those the most?
I'm not saying I'm talking about the conversation. We really haven't had time to digest and
right.
say we'd oppose or support any particular item. I'm just saying that
this is your analysis.
The terms of the conversation
right.
that he set out. And
well, let me raise another term of the conversation, as Dan Cantor from the Working Families Party raised it here a few minutes ago. You could do away with a third of these cuts and tax hikes, as Cantor calculates it anyway, by raising the top interest income tax rate, a scooch, on people making $250,000 a year or more. He says that would wipe out a third of the $15 billion budget gap, and it wouldn't hurt those folks that much. He said if you're making $10,000 a week and you're paying a couple of hundred in taxes more on that $10,000 a week income, that's what it would actually be. So wouldn't scare those people to New Jersey, where there's also high taxes. It would cut a third of the billion of the $15 billion, and might spare some of these other draconian cuts. What do you think about that argument?
Well, number one is numbers are obsolete. He doesn't realize how much incomes have gone down and how much more they're going down in New York State over the next year or two. So it would not solve the problem. That's a false statement. We have to figure how to restructure our expense budget and bring it down. There is no solution, no easy solution, and so I think he's wrong about that. Number two, the question of New York's competitiveness, when you look at right now, our biggest challenge is hanging on to talent, high earners, as many of them have lost their jobs, many more. In New York City, they're talking about 250,000 job losses potentially in the next couple of years. Those are high-end jobs. Those people are mobile. They've got to support their families. They've been paying a high cost structure in New York City. I don't think people are going to flee the city in a negative sense just because of taxes. I think people are fleeing the city. If we don't do something about our economy and stay competitive, they're going to be fleeing the city to find jobs and find a way to support their family, because we are losing a significant number of jobs. And so the income tax and anything that directly affects the job situation and the desire to keep people here. I mean, we're hoping to get investment bankers to go back to school, to come to serve in government, to come into the nonprofit sector and bring some of their skills. We don't want to lose these people.
But it's not a business tax. It's an income tax.
Exactly. And personal income tax is the most sensitive tax when it comes right now. Individuals, particularly in the financial services industry, but across our society, because media is down, retail is down, the talent that makes New York great, that's made us the leader in the global economy, that's made us the leader in the world capital markets, and is that fueled our ability to support education, to support health care. The danger of losing that talent is the number one threat to our society, and people are making life decisions right now.
One more time on this. They say, the Working Families Parties and others say, history suggests that those folks that you're talking about have so much incentive to be in New York that this little difference in taxes is not going to drive them to Charlotte, North Carolina, or for that matter to Bergen County.
That's missing the point. There is no historic precedent except perhaps the Great Depression for what we're about to go through. And that's what they are missing. And that people are making life decisions. They're going to find jobs. Those jobs are not going to be in New York in the next year or two. We've got to have a holding pattern where we keep talent here, hopefully redeploying. And we're working hard with the banks that are doing layoffs and others to redeploy that talent, as I said, in the nonprofit sector, in the government sector, in higher education. We want to keep that talent here. A personal income tax is the worst thing you can do.
Catherine Wild, president of the Partnership for New York City. Kathy, thanks a lot.
Okay, Brian.
A little more on that shoe throwing. I'd say that this, whatever the MTA is going to do, it is not the moral equivalent of the Iraq War, you think? But this just in from the MTA Fair Hike Service Cut hearing, Stephen Millies, an Amtrak worker and self-described subway rider, went on a three-minute rant during the public speaking portion of the MTA board meeting. Toward the end, he asked where MTA CEO Elliot Sander was, then said, "You made $300,000 last year," and apparently bent down to take off his shoe, according to WNYC's Matthew Sherman, who's at the scene. Guards charged him as he yelled, "This shoe's for you." Guards brought him down an elevator to escort him from the building. He was put in cuffs, but we have no information on whether actual charges will be filed or what's happened to him. He was part of a group, by the way, bailoutthepeople.org, formed in the wake of the Wall Street bailout, several members of which testified today. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More reaction to the governor's budget proposals, including your calls. You can start getting in line at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.
We're proposing to close four prison camps and several annexes. As you know, prison population has declined by over 11,000 or 15% compared to 1999. Similar to the plan we put forward in November, we are proposing to close six and downsize two youth facilities and also close three evening reporting centers.
That's Laura Anglin, Governor Patterson's budget director, talking about prison closings as part of the budget proposal yesterday. And so we get reaction to the governor's budget. Guest number four, Bob Ganji, director of the Correctional Association of New York, which advocates for alternatives to incarceration generally. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So react to Laura Anglin's clip there. Is this the big prison consolidation, extra prison closing moment that you've been hoping for?
No. It's a step. The governor's proposed in his budget the closing of four minimum camps. They have a capacity of about 1,200 beds. And as the spokesperson for the division of the budget, we just heard her say the prison population has declined by 11,000 inmates since 1999. It's unique in terms of what's happening in other states across the country, and we think the state could take bigger steps in the direction of downsizing the system, right-sizing the system, and closing prisons other than the minimum camps. They could save more money, and they could create a more efficient and a more fair system and direct resources to programs inside the prisons that provide appropriate treatment for the mentally ill and also that prepare people better prepare people for release back to the community.
So you think the state overspends on prison facilities and as a result underspends on alternatives to incarceration and programs for reentry?
Exactly. And we fear that some of the cuts that the governor has proposed are just moving too aggressively more in that direction. We know there have been cuts to drug treatment programs in the prisons. We know there are cuts to reentry services, and we know there are cuts proposed for many of the programs in the community that formerly incarcerated people turn to when they come out of prison. So if this budget goes through as it's currently proposed, while there'll be a few good things in it in terms of right-sizing the system and saving relatively small amounts of money on what we now spend on juvenile jails and adult prisons, those are only modest steps in the right direction. These cuts can have a very damaging effect, particularly in inner city communities where, for better or worse, most incarcerated people come from. So the particular oversight in the governor's budget was he made no reference to the need for reforming or repealing the Rockefeller drug laws, which are the egregiously harsh mandatory sentencing laws that we still have on the books in New York.
Tell me this before you go. I've heard someone suggest that maybe the recession will, in effect, bring the changes in the Rockefeller drug laws that the policy debate so far can't. Because of
right,
the cuts, there won't be the room for all the prisoners to be sentenced quite as harshly to the extent that judges have discretion, and that this is a backdoor way into that. What do you think?
Well, the problem is that the Rockefeller drug laws include mandatory sentencing provisions, so judges don't have discretion to sentence people to alternative programs or to diversion programs. Under the Rockefeller drug laws, the courts have to send people to prison. We have over 13,000 low-level nonviolent offenders in prison. And we know over the course of the last 35 years that these laws have proven to be unjust, ineffective, and racially biased and extravagantly wasteful. We know that Governor Patterson holds these views on the drug laws. When he was a state senator from Harlem, he got arrested in an act of civil disobedience in a demonstration that we organized outside Governor Pataki's office, demonstration aimed at urging the governor, then Governor Pataki, to exercise leadership and promote repealing the drug laws. Patterson is now in that seat, and he has the ability to exercise the leadership that he was then pressing Governor Pataki to exercise. The fiscal crisis gives him the political cover to move in this direction, save money, and avoid some of the cuts that your previous guests have been talking about.
Bob Ganji, director of the Correctional Association of New York. Thank you very much.
We have to recognize that we've made too many promises and unfortunately have asked for too few sacrifices.
Reaction to the governor's budget? Guest number 5, Brandon Kerner, contributing editor to Wired magazine on the music download tax. Have we made too few sacrifices when we listen to our iPods? Hi, Brandon. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How would this work? Do you understand it?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. Right now, when you download a song or any kind of digital file, whether it be a movie or a picture or even text, you're not paying applicable state and local sales tax. And the way Patterson refers to this, he says it's closing the digital property loophole, is the language he uses. He wants us to pay the same state and local sales tax for digital products as we do if you go down to the store and buy it.
So this is fair, isn't it? Isn't it almost like closing a loophole? I mean, if I buy a CD in a store, I pay the state sales tax. Why should music I buy online be treated differently?
Well, that's the argument. I guess the argument from those who provide these services is that they're not taking up actual real estate in the city or the state. They're not using services in the state. You know, so many of these businesses are located out of state, so they're going to say it's unfair for them to have to pay for essentially New York State services if they're located in, say, California or Texas.
If songs become more expensive because of the tax, could there be a move on iTunes to open up the download license so that the songs could be played on multiple devices? Because right now, as you know, they have a premium download option for that.
Yeah, that's certainly something that has been in the works or has been discussed for quite some time. I think this could, in fact, you know, kind of speed the end of the universal 99-cent rule. Right now, every single song on iTunes costs 99 cents, whether it's the number one single in the country or the most obscure song imaginable. And I think a lot of people have been pushing for a sliding scale so that you might have to pay, you know, over a dollar for the number one song, but maybe only 19 or 29 cents for those from an up-and-coming band.
That's interesting. That would kind of give people an incentive to buy music that isn't already so popular.
That's exactly the idea. You know, I think what's important here from the standpoint of iTunes and stores selling for 99 cents is that there's a real psychological barrier when you break the $1 mark. You have to keep in mind that before, you know, iTunes and other stores were selling these for 99 cents, people were generally getting them for free via Napster and other file sharing services. And I think keeping it in two figures kind of made it palatable for those people. So I think going over the $1 mark is going to be kind of a big deal for some folks.
That would be pretty interesting. Charging more for more popular pieces of music. It's like you know the Yankees charge more than the Kansas City Royals. So maybe the big name music could bring in more. It's interesting to see what that would do actually to the arts. Last thing, what about not-for-profit free podcasts?
Yeah.
Would they be taxed?
This is going to be an issue. I think that the language in the budget proposal is only about two sentences long, and it says it covers everything that's electronically delivered. So there, I think there's going to be a lot of people raising their hands and saying, hey, can we have an exclusion here? And certainly nonprofits are going to be first in line saying they shouldn't apply to them.
But seriously, not to ignore my vested interest in the wide distribution of free podcasts from not-for-profit media organizations, but if it's being offered for free already, is there any mechanism in this to levy a tax so people would have to pay something on the nothing?
I very much doubt that's going to happen. You know, obviously, they're going to have to build some kind of mechanism so these vendors are collecting sales taxes. So iTunes is going to have to build that in.
Right.
You guys, probably not so much. So I wouldn't lose too much sleep over having people to charge, you know, 8.5% on nothing.
Brandon Corner, contributing editor to Wired. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.